Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I will be with you on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, and on irishradio.com. So, whether you're here in New York City or further afield, sit back, relax. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House NYU is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the generosity of Loretta Brennan Glucksman and Lou Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and dynamic centre of learning on the Irish experience in the United States, in Ireland, and indeed the global Irish diaspora. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews in Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope that you had another good week. Here at Glucksman Ireland House NYU, we are getting ready for the start of our Spring 15 semester. We find it hard to believe that we're into the spring semester already of this busy academic year, but we are on Monday, January 26th. We'll be back at full throttle with our undergraduate and graduate classes. We're coming into the key season for applications to our Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies. I have mentioned over recent weeks the dates of our open houses. We have an open house on February 13th and on March 13th. So if you are thinking about expanding your knowledge of the Irish experience in the United States or in Ireland or somewhere else in the world, do consider this Master of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies. It is a fantastic program. It is my honor to have a hand in running the program and on occasion on teaching the program. It's really enriching to see what people get out of this fantastic program. So if you're interested in finding out more about it, do get in touch with us. You can email us anytime at ireland.house@nyu.edu, or you can sign on and come along to our open houses. We'd be delighted to welcome you, and you'll have an opportunity to meet our alumni and some of our current students and some of the faculty members. Now, on today's program, I have two very interesting guests sitting down and chatting to me. One is Mr. Frank Naughton. Frank is the editor of the New York Irish History Roundtable Journal, and I'm delighted that Frank has taken the time out to come in and tell us a little bit about the latest volume of their journal. For anyone who's not aware of either the New York Irish History Roundtable or the journal that they produce, it's a really great place and it should be a touch point for anyone interested in the history of Irish New York and the Irish in the United States more generally. So Frank is going to run through, if any of you tuned in last week, you will have heard Joe Long talk about his research on the Irish in Chelsea. So Frank is going to fill us in a little bit more as to what else we can expect in this lovely publication. I'm also delighted to be able to share with you a chat that I had recently with a fine historian called Gerard McAtasney. You may remember that Gerard has written quite extensively on the Irish famine, not only in the north of Ireland in Belfast, but he's written quite a lot on the famine history of Leitrim. He's also somebody who quite early on had undertaken some really important research on some of the people involved in 1916. And he has written really a great biography of Tom Clarke. And as many of you know, Tom Clarke was a signatory of the Proclamation of the Republic in 1916, someone who we now deem as probably being one of the masterminds behind Easter 1916 in Ireland, a really important historical figure who has been overlooked a little bit. But Gerard McAtasney went back and did some digging into the life of Tom Clarke. So I wanted to get an opportunity to share some of that fascinating research with you. Now, folks, before we move on to those interviews, I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that the Irish animated film Song of the Sea is now playing at New York City's IFC Center. This film was honored with an Academy Award nomination recently for Best Animated Feature Film. It's made by the same people, if any of you saw that lovely film a few years ago called The Book of Kells. Song of the Sea is directed, I believe, by the same director. It's based on the Irish legend of the Selkies, And Song of the Sea tells the story of the last sea child, Saoirse, and her brother Ben, who go on an epic journey to save the world of magic and discover the secrets of their past. I want you to just get a sneak preview, as it were, by listening to the trailer for Song of the Sea. And as I said, I'd highly recommend any of you who are interested in checking it out. It may not be here for long, folks. It's running at IFC. Some dates next week, I believe. So make sure you go out and take your opportunity to see it in a movie theatre while you can. So here's the trailer of Song of the Sea.
This is an ancient shell that my mother gave me a long time ago. Hold it to your ear and listen carefully. You will hear the song of the sea.
Mom? I'm so sorry.
Say hello to Saoirse.
Oh, Granny. She's going to try and make us move to the city again.
At last! We found her!
Saoirse! Run!
Those stories that Mum told me, they're all true. Are you really a Selkie?
Us are connected, and we'll all share in our fate.
I have to find her.
Here in Luxman Ireland House NYU, sitting with someone who is no stranger to us here on many levels. And what I'm here to talk to Frank Naughton about today is the latest journal of the New York Irish History, which is the annual journal of the New York Irish History Roundtable. Welcome, Frank. Frank Naughton is the editor of this wonderful journal. We're so delighted to have received this copy, volume 27. The most recent edition. And as we have chatted in the past with one of the contributors, Joe Long, about his article about the Irish on the waterfront, and I just wanted to take an opportunity to have a chat more generally with Frank about the contents of this most recent edition of New York Irish History. Welcome, Frank, to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. Your first time chatting with us, hopefully the first of many.
Okay, I'll look forward to that.
I'm holding you to that now, Frank. So maybe we just start off by just chatting about the process by which, how do you kind of put together what's going to be in each edition of New York Irish History?
Well, I have great advantage because I'm an editor who loves the material and frequently, or I would say almost all the time, I'm working with authors who are very, very devoted to the material, to the Irish in New York City, and they put together some very, very good articles for me to edit. So when I receive them, I'm just fascinated by the material, and I'm in awe of some of the research that people have done to put the articles together. We have a variety of sources that we get articles through. One of the important sources that we have is our connection to institutions that receive annual copies of New York Irish History. And I would include in that certainly Glucksman Ireland House. A number of the articles that we get come as a result of graduate students going through the Irish Studies program at Glucksman Ireland House. And they do theses and they do other forms of writing, some of which get recommended to us. All of the ones that we publish, we're happy to have. Another important source that we have is the scholarships that we offer. We offer scholarships annually at the graduate level, and those scholarships are known in a variety of colleges and universities around the country. And the graduate students submit the materials to us for the scholarship, and we put together a group that evaluates the scholarship materials submitted to us, and some of those scholarship winners in fact wind up being published in New York Irish History.
You're speaking to one of the recipients of,
yes,
that, of those,
right?
Yes,
I know I am. I remember that very well. We also have a presence on the internet. We have our own New York Irish History Roundtable website, and people can look at past articles that we've published, and we also encourage people to submit to us through the website. So we have a variety of sources that feed into us, and as a result, I personally see probably 5 or 6 possible articles for every publication that we receive. We don't publish them all, but we publish a good percentage of them. So I would get the submission usually in digital form. Sometimes it's hard copy. And if necessary, I circulate it among a couple of our board members or people outside the roundtable for their evaluation of the material. And if the evaluations come back to me positive, then we're on the road to publication, and I get in touch with the authors, and you know, we go through copy editing, and we go through picture research, and we go through any final touch-ups and revisions that are necessary.
So you never have a shortage, really, of material, Frank,
which is encouraging. Up to this point, we have never had a shortage of material.
So for those of our listeners, Frank, who may not be familiar with them, would you mind telling us a little bit about the organization, in case there are people out there who'd be interested in becoming members?
Sure, I would. Without the organization, the annual journal doesn't exist. So, yeah, New York Irish History Roundtable is made up currently of about 350 people in the New York, New Jersey metropolitan area mostly, but we have members as far away as California and Belgium and Ireland. And these people share this common interest in what has gone on and what has been the experience of the Irish in the New York City metropolitan area. And that includes, you know, nearby states in New England. It includes New Jersey, certainly. And the Roundtable is a voluntary organization. It's really open to anybody who has this interest. There are some academics in the organization, but most of the members are simply people who like to know about and maybe discuss and hear about the history of the Irish in the New York metropolitan area. The Roundtable has 4 or 5 programs that it puts on each year. These are lectures or talks. Sometimes they're walking tours. Sometimes they're musical programs accompanied by expert critiques. And these are open to the members free of charge. And we have 2 newsletters that we get out each year. And those are intended to tell people about the roundtable and about what's going on among the Irish in New York City to some extent, and what the roundtable is planning to do in the future.
Great. Just for the benefit of anyone who's interested in finding out more, I suppose the best port of call is the website www.irishnyhistory.org. So we've heard a bit about Joe Long's, the first article in volume 27 of New York Irish History. Can you tell me a little bit just about, for the benefit of our listeners, how Joe Long's research on the Irish in Chelsea and Greenwich Village came to your attention and things like that?
Well, it came to my attention, in fact, really through 2 ways. I myself was very interested in the Irish in Greenwich Village. I lived in Greenwich Village in New York City for over 45 years, and I did my own doctoral dissertation on an aspect of New York City's Greenwich Village in the early 20th century, not the Irish in the village, but essentially the working class and radicals in New York City in the early 20th century. So I've always been fascinated by this section of Manhattan and the people in it. And as a consequence, as I began to get more and more interested in the work of the New York Irish History Roundtable, I began to get more and more interested in the Irish in Greenwich Village. And I began actually talking to some people and putting some material together in hopes of doing an article. And I began to hear about this other guy who was was, in a sense, covering some of the same material. And not long after that, Marion Casey got in touch with me and told me about a thesis that was very close to being finished on the Irish in Chelsea and Greenwich Village. And since the two areas really are just adjacent to each other, I was lucky enough to get a look at Joe's thesis and immediately, you know, started pursuing it as two articles because the thesis itself was quite long.
Mm-hmm.
So he and I agreed that it could be divided into two articles, and we were off and running to publishing it.
It's a very rich meditation on that very interesting, as you say, adjacent community of Greenwich Village and Chelsea and the waterfront aspect that we think we know a lot about, you know, various things, the movie On the Waterfront and things like that. It's great,
yes,
to see some scholarship really going back, and I had the opportunity to listen to one or two of the oral histories that Joe collected. And with your own background, Frank, I'm sure, and I think this comes through in the article, the fact that he's of the community, there's so much colour and nuance, and he gets stuff out of people that I just don't think anyone else, someone of the place really, that insider-outsider aspect of his research is great.
Yes, I know when I was talking to some of the people in Greenwich Village, having lunch with some of them in a group, it was clear to me that, friendly as they were, and even though I've lived in Greenwich Village for over 40 years, it was clear to me that it was a much closer aspect of their relationship than the relationship that I had with any one of them. So someone like Joe had an enormous advantage in being able to elicit the richness of the people and the society when he was doing his work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So then the next article is on Patrick Sarsfield Gilmore. For the benefit of our listeners, Frank, can you tell us a little bit about how this article, very interesting guy, and how this article came about for you?
I wish I could tell you, but I can't. Jarlath McNamara is a resident of County Kildare, and out of the blue, I got an email message asking if the New York Irish History Roundtable would be interested in seeing a manuscript dealing with Patrick Sarsfield Gilmore, and I ignored it. I ignored it because I was very busy at that time with, I think it was volume 26 or maybe volume 25. I sort of ignored it. I said, well, if I get a chance to respond, I will. But in any case, Jarlath persisted. He sent another email, and I responded saying, sure, send it along. So he sent me an email attachment with the manuscript, and to this day I've become very friendly with him, but I haven't pursued the question of how exactly he found out about the roundtable or about how he found out about our journal. In any case, he produced ultimately a wonderful, wonderful piece of work on Patrick Sarsfield Gilmore, the father of the American band, and he produced an enormous amount of very rich illustrations, which I think, you know, if somebody picks up the journal and looks at it, it's just a pleasure to look at the illustrations.
And do you know, I see that you note within the article, Frank, that he's been collecting memorabilia and ephemera related to Gilmore over a long period of time. Is there a family connection that you know of, or do you know what whetted his interest in this figure?
I think it stems mainly from two aspects of Jarlath's life. One, he himself, Jarlath McNamara, is a piano teacher, so I think he has a love and appreciation for music. Secondly, I think they both came from the same hometown. They both came from the same place.
Okay.
Yeah. So there is that. He's probably, you know, grown up in music and with an awareness of Gilmore and what Gilmore did.
So, like so many of the articles capture in New York Irish history, you really do a good job. Gilmore, or P.S. Gilmore, as he would have been known, you know, a very well-known figure across North America in his period, and now, you know, really only small numbers of historians or really people interested in him are familiar with who he is, you know, when you're uncovering that kind of hidden history a little bit.
Yeah, Gilmore is sort of lost. I think when, you know, if you were to ask most Americans, like, who do you think of when you think of band music or marching music in America, most Americans probably would say, oh, John Philip Sousa. And in fact, Gilmore is a forerunner of John Philip Sousa, and really is more of an archetype and a major influence than Sousa was, or at least he's equal to Sousa.
Fascinating. It's a very, very interesting article, and the, as you say, Frank, the images that you have accompanying it are really lovely and well worth people taking a look at and picking up this volume of New York Irish history. The next article on the Bronx Irish in the mid-19th century by Harry Duncack. Can you tell us a little bit about that one, Frank?
Harry Duncack is an Irish Christian brother who has had a long and rich experience teaching at Iona College up in New Rochelle, and has a sterling reputation as a scholar of the Irish and the Irish in the United States. He came to us again. I think he was, if not himself a member, Iona was a member, an institutional member of the Round Table. So he knew about our publication, and this is the second article that we published by him. And he previously had written about special Irish collections that researchers could use at Iona College in their library. This time he wanted to write about Irish and Irish Americans in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. So again, he came to us.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's lovely. I've a student helping me here who is from the Bronx, and it's fascinating to see. She happened to be looking through some of my stuff the other day, Frank, and she came across stuff to do with, I think, the United Irish Counties FESH or something on in the Bronx. And, you know, this is a young 18-year-old NYU student who has no conscience really of the Irish footprint on the place, at least from her own direct experience. It's just fascinating to see a young generation of people engaging with, in this case, quite a historical document, and thinking about the people who were there before, and thinking about the change and ethnic succession and change in terms of the city, and just generally how one group moves on a little bit, or, you know, are less visible in some ways. And it takes these kind of journals and this kind of research to put it back to the forefront or remind people of the history of the place.
Another person like that, whom I think you know, is Kate Feary.
Mm-hmm.
Kate Feary is a young woman who not so long ago completed graduate studies here at Glucksman Ireland House. And she wrote about the Bronx.
Mm-hmm. Highbridge, right?
Her mm-hmm. family is from Highbridge, and she did a dissertation on the Irish in Highbridge.
Mm-hmm.
And we published two or three separate articles by Kate Feary on the Irish in Highbridge, which is a wonderful set of materials
mm-hmm.
on the history of Highbridge and the Irish in the history of Highbridge.
And more generally, when you step out of even, you know, if you're not interested in the Irish, the history of New York and the development of the, you know, and change of the city as a city, you know, more generally, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, Highbridge in many ways exemplifies the expansion of the growing New York into the boroughs.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it's the Bronx. But the Bronx was a stepping stone
mm-hmm.
from people living in poorer areas of Manhattan
mm-hmm.
to more attractive housing and more attractive community resources in the boroughs. Some people moved to Queens, some moved to Staten Island, some moved to the Bronx,
mm-hmm.
and many of the Irish moved to Highbridge.
When the next article is on something that's very close to my own heart and is written by someone who I deeply admire as a scholar in the field, John Ridge's, I'm delighted that he's done a part three to his research on the county colonies. Those specific links of the clustering of Irish people and allegiance to county that play themselves out in New York City. The article is entitled Irish County Colonies in New York City by John T. Ridge. We think that we've heard it all from John on this, but he always has something in the back burner, and another fascinating article,
right,
really mapping out the subdivision of the Irish community in New York
yeah.
through counties.
Yes, yes. This is John's last installment for now, for now, on the Irish counties in New York, but he's publishing something in the next journal. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but that will be, I think, exciting also. John is a wonderful gentleman to work with. He is one of the earliest members and, I believe, a founder or a founding member of the New York Irish History Roundtable. his name pops up in volume 1 of New York Irish History and in volume 2 of New York Irish History. We're now working on volume 28 of New York Irish History, and his name will and his work will be in volume 28 also. He's truly a gentleman and a scholar and a very generous man in sharing his knowledge and information about the Irish in New York. John is a scholar. He's not a formal scholar. I think John has a bachelor's degree, and that's it. But he has devoted enormous amounts of time to understanding the Irish through his love of the Irish and Irish culture.
And that dedicated impulse of collecting and saving things that we really, you know, without him, we would be the world of what we can do and will be able to do in the future in terms of reflecting on the Irish experience in New York and in the United States more generally would just not be as rich.
So you don't have to be a PhD to be a scholar.
Absolutely not. These articles, folks, are really, you know, really fascinating. They're all tying back to a link to the Irish experience in New York generally, and are really quite diverse and rich in their reach and highly recommended. But the remainder of the journal, Frank, is devoted to book reviews. I mean, really, if you want to know what's going on in terms of anything to do with Irish history, this is a fantastic resource. Tell me about pulling these. I mean, you've quite a number of book reviews here. Do you always do as many in each edition? It's a great resource for people who are interested in what's going on.
Yeah, I think we do between 7 and 10 reviews in each journal. Most of them are indeed book reviews, but there are also reviews of film and reviews of plays, and occasionally even reviews of television series, all which must be focused on the Irish, and mostly on the Irish in New York City metropolitan area. We have a special, and we're lucky to have her, a special editor for the review section, and that's Linda Dowling Almeida. And largely she makes suggestions for books to review. I also add a little bit to the book review or film review content. But it is essentially Linda who finds the people to do the reviews for us and handles the busy work of connecting the book or the other material with the person doing the review.
She does a great job, and I know she enjoys it. We're delighted to have that connection through Linda, who's a member of our faculty and co-director of the Archives of Irish America Oral History Collection.
Yeah, so please praise her as much as you can.
Yeah, no, we're big fans of Linda. She's a wonderful colleague. So just for the benefit of the listeners, in this volume of New York Irish History, volume 27, there is a review of the Irish American experience in New Jersey and Metropolitan New York, Cultural Identity, Hybridity and Commemoration by Marta Mestrovic Dayrup and Maura Grace Harrington. We are delighted, actually, we have a couple of our MA alums, our Irish Studies Masters alums, made contributions, and Linda herself actually contributed an article which is very interesting on shedding light on the Irish experience more specifically in New Jersey. There's a review of James K. Maguire, Boy Mayor and Irish Nationalist. That book is by Joseph E. Fahey. We've a review of Terry Galway's wonderful work, Machine Made, Tammany Hall and the Creation of Modern American Politics. We also have a review of Orphan Train, which is a novel by Christina Baker Klein. And moving on, we have a review of Alice MacDermott's Someone. We've a review of Maura Mulligan's memoir, Call of the Lark, a memoir. We've a review of Eamon Lunshig's Light of the Diddy Coy. And we've reviews of Outside Mullingar, John Patrick Shanley's play, which was directed by Doug Hughes. That's to your point on not just limiting yourselves to the books, Frank.
Yes.
And finally, a review of Finding Your Irish Ancestors in New York City by Joseph Buggy. So it really is a fantastic resource for people interested in what's going on in terms of the history of the Irish in New York and a little bit more generally on the Irish experience in the United States. So to go full circle, Frank, we're delighted to have the connections with you in terms of faculty. And we've mentioned a few, you know, Joe Long is in this edition, and we've mentioned that Kate, who had done our Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies, has contributed. We hope that that collaboration will continue. And that's among many other people who have, you know, intersecting interests between Luxembourg Ireland House and the New York Irish History Roundtable. For any of you interested, the website again is www.irishnyhistory.org. Frank, thanks for coming in to have a chat to us, and congratulations on another fine publication.
Thank you.
When is volume 28 expected? Later this year, or?
Volume 28 will be out just before Thanksgiving this okay. year. We always celebrate Thanksgiving.
Okay. Well, fair play to you. I know a lot of work goes into pulling it together, and it's a fantastic resource, and it's a great publication for people to go to and enjoy. How do people go about getting a copy of the journal, Frank? By becoming a member?
Yeah, the journal is free to all members. And if people who are not members of the Roundtable would like it, if they just contact us through the website, as you said earlier, we will make one available to them. The charge for each individual journal is $10 to outsiders.
Okay. So very reasonable. There's a lot of reading in it, and it's highly recommended. Thanks for taking time out today, Frank, on a kind of a cold January day here in New York City, and good luck with volume 28.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure at Ireland House.
I'm here with Gerard McAtasney, who was a guest on the programme a while back when he was talking to us about his book, The Dead Buried by the Dying, The Great Famine in Leitrim. Gerard, I wanted to take the opportunity to have a chat to you today about someone upon whom you wrote a very interesting biography, and someone who was a resident of New York, the New York City area, for a while in the late 19th and early 20th century. That's Tom Clark, signatory of the 1916 Proclamation of the Republic. Can you tell me a little bit about your research on Tom Clark and his time in New York in particular?
Well, the interesting thing about it was that Tom Clark's son, youngest son, Emmett, only died a few years ago. He was close to being 100 years of age when he died. And I had written to him when I was working on the biography of Sean McDermott, which came out in 2004, but I was told that his wife was extremely protective and didn't want anybody interviewing him. But he died, and his letters then were auctioned, and they were purchased by the National Library.
In Dublin,
National Library Dublin, yes. So I found this out. Letters, documents, anything to do with 1916, around about 2005, 2006, and seven was fetching massive money. I mean, the proclamation the day I was at the auction, and I wasn't paying anything, but the proclamation sold for $350,000, I think, that night. I think they're now about $70,000. But one of the things was that I had been asked by a donor who had lent me very important material pertaining to McDermott if I could find a buyer. I'm totally against that sort of thing, because as far as I'm concerned, historical documents are part of a jigsaw that's used to build up a biography. But he wanted to sell them, so they sold for about a total of about €160,000, and in amongst that was McDermott's 1916 medal, which was awarded posthumously, which sold for €130,000. This boy didn't even know the value of it. He just said he had an oil medal, as he said. But so the long story short, the auctioneers then said, if I ever needed any help in future, you know, so I said, well, I rang him about a year later, said, you sold those letters, who's got them? National Library. Contacted a friend in the National Library and got access to these letters from Tom Clark. Now, there were much more than his letters, various documents relating to his prison time and petitions and various items to do with buying rifles leading up to the rising. So I dived into this because I know there's going to be a lot of material coming to 1916. There hadn't been a biography written about Clark since 1936. Nothing, very, very little. He was the quiet man of the rising, stayed in the background, and I thought, right, let's get into these letters. And the letters offer a fascinating insight from the human perspective. They're divided into three main categories, which would be the private letters, then there are the prison letters, and then the political letters. Now, you can understand the political letters don't contain that much simply because these people did not talk openly. You know, for example, the British in 1915 had the letters of a variety of people, including Bulmer Hobson, Tom Clark, Sean McDermott, or Kathleen Clark. They had them censored for 6 months or so, and they opened them up, and after 6 months he just said, listen, there's no point in continuing this, because these people obviously receive the important correspondence by other means. A lot of it was oral communication, you know, with trusted individuals. So the letters that begin certainly in New York in 1899, when Clark's released from prison in 1898, September 1898, after 15 and a half years of absolute hell, during which time two of his comrades went insane, and the British denied they were insane. And then as soon as these two men were released, after pressure from the American press and the American State Office, various people getting involved, these two men were immediately admitted to Amityville in New York, which was a hospital for the insane. So they've been driven insane. And one of the letters Clark actually writes to John Redman, and it's one of the interesting facts that come out of the book, is that John Redman was a very close confidant of Tom Clark. This is John Redman, the Irish Parliamentary Party leader. Yeah, he was a solicitor, and together with Maud Gonne, they fought hard for the prisoners to get them released. And Clark actually said, when he was released in September 1898, that one of the men he really wanted to thank most was John Redman, which is ironic given what happened in later years. But in 1895, Clark writes a letter to Redman describing how one of his comrades is in a workshop, and he looks over, and the prisoners were not allowed to talk. If you talked to each other, it was a bread and water diet for a week or so, solitary confinement. And he just writes to Redman, this is what I saw, and one of the men is forcing glass into his mouth. He's eating glass. He's gone insane. And Clark goes over to him and says, what are you doing? And he says, sure, a pound of it wouldn't do you any harm. And you know, but the English, the British, the administration were still denying that these men were insane. So that's one aspect of the letters. Clark arrives here in 1899. The interesting thing is that as soon as he was released from prison, he tried to do what his great friend John Daly from Limerick had done. John Daly was in prison from about 1886 onwards until 1894. He was released. John Daly, as soon as he got out, he was a prominent Fenian. He led the attack on Kilmallock Barracks in Limerick in 1867. And he wrote to John Devoy and asked him to organise a lecture tour for him. And Devoy did this for John Daly, and it was a massive success, and it set Daly up for the rest of his life. He was able to go back home to Limerick, establish a bakery, became Lord Mayor of Limerick in 1898-1899, became a very prominent citizen. Clark was released, did the same thing, followed the same procedure, and Devoy was not interested in the slightest. Now, unfortunately, the letter that Devoy sent back has been lost. In fact, I use the term lost. I'm convinced that either Kathleen Clark or Madge Daly, her sister, disposed of the letter. Because there's actually a letter where Sean McDermott is mentioned in 1909. This is in the National Museum in Dublin. And I noticed that there was a part, seemed to be part of a sentence missing. And when I actually looked at it very, very closely, it said that McDermott was one of Hobson's clique, but Bulmer Hobson fell foul of Clark from about 1912 onwards. This is a classic case of historic revisionism, that either Madge Daly or Kathleen Daly Clark had erased the reference to Bulmer Hobson in this one letter. You know, so it's one of the many fascinating aspects that comes out of the correspondence.
Why do you think Devoy didn't set up the tour for Clark?
Devoy was a notoriously prickly character. Notoriously prickly. And if you read Terry Galway's biography of him, it certainly makes reference to this. Huge amount of work would have gone into organising it, and at this stage Devoy was looking at setting up what became the Irish American, the major newspaper, which ironically then, the Gaelic American, which ironically then saw Clark and Devoy work together. Devoy was the editor and Clark was a sub-editor, you know, and basically did an awful lot of other jobs as well. So they did work together. That's one of the interesting things about Clark, is he didn't seem to bear grudges. He was quite happy to work with Devoy, but Devoy was an awkward character to work with. That seems to be the rationale for it, but it's one of those things where there's actually a very touching letter from Clark to Kathleen Daly, she was at that stage. And it's interesting that, you know, these two met as soon as Clark was released from prison. 20-year age gap. In some of the accounts, in fact, in Louis LaRue's account of the Clark biography of 1936, which is very much a hagiography rather than a biography, but he says how, you know, Kathleen was enamoured with this man. He was a hero, and, you know, she just fell in love with him straight away. Actually, in her memoir, she said how the first time she ever met Tom Clark, she was so disappointed because she had heard from her uncle, John Daly, that this man was a great Irishman, a hero. And she said, I met an old, stooped over, you know, a man who looked 15, 20 years older than I actually was, you know. But she said, I soon grew to fall in love with him.
How do you think he would have been greeted by the Irish community in New York at that point? I mean, these were famed Fenian activists, right?
His letters actually are very, very revealing, because he's not impressed with what he sees. And the thing about Clark, there are two aspects to the letters. Well, there are a number, but certainly two that I can think of at the minute. Number one is the sense of humour that he has in the letters. And for a man who spent 15 and a half years in prison. And number two is the fortitude that he shows. That he comes out, and in 1899, his first letter, he's writing back home to Jim Birmingham, a colleague, a Republican colleague in Dublin. And he's saying, people in New York are talking about doing things, but all they're doing is talking. They're not actually doing anything. What he was making reference to was the fact that the Boer War had just started. Britain was heavily involved in South Africa from 1899 to 1901. And it was the old Republican adage of, you know, England's difficulties, Ireland's opportunity. And this actually haunted Clark, and it was one of the main catalysts for his participation in the 1916 rising, was that, you know, we didn't do anything. when the opportunity was there during the Boer War, the next time England enters war, and this is somewhat used like using musical terms, like a leitmotif from about 1908 onwards in Republican correspondence. You know, the next time there's an opportunity, we will strike. Regardless, you know, we cannot let, and this was a very strong strain of thought with Clark and his generation, was that you always paid homage to the generation before that had made the effort. And it certainly seems to me that for Clark and McDiarmid and their generation, the Manchester Martyrs of 1867 were to them what 1916 became to the generation of Republicans from 1970s onwards, that they looked to them as the template, as the reason, the principal reason for what they were engaging in. So Clark was under no illusion that the next time something happens, we must strike. And he was disgusted with what he saw in New York. And he actually talked about setting up a variety of businesses, making shoes, selling Irish bog turf, that sort of stuff. And he's writing to Kathleen Daly, and the fascinating thing about it is you feel privileged because there are a couple of hundred of these letters, and you're reading letters that were never meant for the public. I mean, these are very, very personal, intimate letters between two people who were deeply, deeply in love. And he writes then at length, and the interesting thing, you know, is that he'd write a letter and then he'd say, listen, it's 12 o'clock, I have to go to bed, and he'd start writing the next day, and the letters could be maybe 10 pages long then and contain information over a week or so. But he writes of New York that he wants to set up his own business. He's hoping that some of his friends, and when Clark and his people wrote with friends with a capital F, that was Fenians, that was Clannagale. So, you know, he was in the Clannagale over here, and he said he hoped that some of them would help him, but he wasn't going to become a party man. He wasn't going to be divided between them. He said that everybody wants a piece of me, and that's not going to happen. So he's very, very principled, and he knew, he despised the divisions that were going on. For example, Maud Gonne, there was a visit by Maud Gonne in about 1901, and he just said, you know, it's been organised by what he termed a body of cranks who are just out for their own aggrandizement, whereas he, having spent his time in prison, he had the one goal, the one focus, which was, you know, how do we tackle England's colonisation position in Ireland? What do we do about it? Let's stop talking. Let's do something.
So he doesn't spend too long in New York, Gerard. Can you tell us the sequence of events or what brings him back from Ireland at that point?
Well, the vast majority of the letters are between himself and his fiancée, as she was then, Kathleen Daly. And he is really going mad to get her over to Ireland. But unfortunately, she's the main witness in a case involving one of his friends, which was just an accident in Dublin. And she can't leave. So the letters are all about, you know, how he's missing her and how she's missing him and what can they do to get over her. So she eventually arrives over. They get married. And then he lives in a variety of areas throughout New York. But they're always struggling for money. And then they have a son who's born around about 1905. And after that, and she never mentions it in her own work, Kathleen Clark's autobiography, she seems to suffer serious health problems. She's sent upstate to what seems to be some sort of a retreat. Now, she never mentions this, but it's in the letters. And so they always seem to be short of money. So he moves out to Manorville and buys a farm out there.
That's on Long Island.
Yeah. He ends up with two farms. And he writes a very, very detailed letter home to John Daly about how he's proven a great success as a farmer and the sprays that he's using and how the locals can't believe that he can look after the data so well. And he says it's his Irish background, etc., etc. John Daly was the man who was in prison with him, who became Lord Mayor of Cork. John Daly is an absolutely crucial part of this story. There's a photograph of Clark Daly and Sean McDiarmid in 1915. And I would argue that that's, without those three men, you would never have had a 1916 rising, because John Daly is by this stage a moneyed man, very, very well off. And he backs everything that happens in Ireland from the return of Clark, newspapers, pilgrimages to Wolfe Tone's grave, etc., etc. So Manorville is purchased in the name of Tom Clark, but actually John Daly buys it. And in his letters he says, right, we've bought it, now we're going to put it into your name. But it proves a failure. They just can't adapt to the country life. They still have money problems and they're forced to come home. Now, there is this sort of hypothesis that Clark returned to start a rise, and he arrives home in December 1907, and, you know, things start to move from there. I actually had an interview with his two nieces 3 years ago, it would have been, down in Limerick. Elderly women.
Either whose nieces?
Tom Clark's nieces. It would have been actually his nieces by marriage. It would be nieces of Kathleen Clark and Kathleen Daly. One of them was maybe 90 years of age. Very, very sharp. And they were telling me that, you know, the Dalys, for example, they had their own cook. They had their own gardener. And they were saying how their mother, who would have been the youngest sister of the Dalys, Kathleen Daly's youngest sister, she didn't know how to cook, which was highly unusual at the time because they were so well off, they didn't need, you know. So they were extremely wealthy, certainly by local standards. They lived in a very posh part of the town, lovely house and all that. And the Daly supported Tom Clark in everything that he did. So he arrived home very, very poor, but he arrived home on the basis not to start a rising or anything like this, because this is real life you're talking about, and that's what comes through in the letters, is this man wasn't obsessed with British rule in Ireland. He had a wife and child by this stage. And he starts looking for a property in Dublin. And that always interested me. You know, why did Clark open a tobacconist shop? Everybody knows he had a tobacconist shop. And why? Because his sister had a tobacconist shop. Simple as that. She was the sole agent in Ireland for the Gaelic Ireland newspaper he had worked on with...
The Gaelic American.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. The Gaelic American with John Devoy. So, again, in the letters, lots of family tensions. He didn't get on well with his mother. He didn't get on well with this sister, Hannah. But he pays tribute to her for the fact that she helped him pick the premises in Parnell Street and, you know, set up contracts for various newspapers and that sort of thing. And his letters are all about this. I mean, he writes a letter to Kathleen, who's down in Limerick, who's about to have their second child. So she's down there, he's up by himself, and he paints a picture of the shop, which is just so graphic. I mean, he talks about the wallpaper that's there, the colour of it, the design of it, what the floor is like. I mean, it's really, you feel like you're standing in Tom Clark's shop. You know, so he comes back to start up this business, not to start a raisin. He's had financial difficulties, and he actually makes reference to the fact that, you know, this business will work really, really well for us. It's just a pity we have such a huge amount of debt to clear off before us. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and this is an aspect of Tom Clark's life which has never been discussed before.
Now, am I correct in thinking, Gerard, he did two stints in the US, right? He'd been here earlier?
Yes, he'd been here. He actually had to get out in 1880. He had been living in Dungannon, so along with Connolly, who lived in Belfast for a while, he was only, well, and Sean McDermott, who lived there as well for a couple of years, but he had lived most of his life in Dungannon from about the age of 7 to the age of 22 or so, and together with his great friend Billy Kelly, they both were forced to leave Dungannon after an attack on the RIC in August 1880. There had been a march, a Catholic march, which had been attacked by Loyalists, and then the following day there was a riot, and it's said, though there's no direct evidence to support it, but it's said that Clark was involved in firing shots at the RIC, but certainly would seem to be corroborated by the fact that he didn't hang about. He got out pretty fast, went to Derry, and then took the boat to America, joined the Napper-Tandy branch of the Clonmacnoise, and lived here for about a year and a half, was actively involved in Republican politics over here with the Clonmacnoise, and then, as he said, you know, the call went out for single men to go back to Britain, rather, go to Britain to carry out a campaign, which was extremely secretive at the time, but it was all thrown up in the air by the fact that Jeremiah O'Donovan Rossa was openly advertising in the local American papers for people to supply him with arms and explosives, which was legal in those days. You could do that as long as they weren't going to be used on American soil. So what he was doing was sending a team of operators over to Britain to carry out a bombing campaign. And this went spectacularly wrong. There were people killed, innocent civilians killed, and it got to the stage where they were just bombing the nearest building that they could find out of a taxi, you know. And the difference was that the Clonmacnoise, with John Devoy at the helm, they pinpointed a long-term campaign where they would send Clark and others over and they would manufacture the explosives in Britain so as not to attract any unwanted attention from the police. And this idea then was scuppered because the British police were on high alert after the Jeremiah O'Donovan Rossa campaign. So Clark was arrested then in 1883 and was jailed on the word of an informer along with half a dozen of his colleagues. In March 1883, he was sentenced to penal servitude for life.
So Tom Clark then would have had contact of O'Donovan Rossa here then in that early period, would he?
No, O'Donovan Rossa was actually seen as a loose cannon by the Clonmacnoise. He was out on his own, and there's actually a report that members of the Clonmacnoise turned informer because they wanted him out of the picture because he was doing damage. He was actually drawing attention to what they wanted to do as a long-term project, which was bomb targeted English buildings.
Mm-hmm.
British Parliament, I think it was London Bridge actually, that Clark was given the job of doing. And O'Donovan Rossa then was seen as being a loose cannon.
Would you say then, based on your research, sir, that Tom Clark's, you know, sense of identity or sense of Irishness was tied to like a kind of Tyrone? I mean, he considered himself, because he's born, is it at the Isle of Wight he's born?
Well, I mean, when I was writing the book, I put a letter in the Irish Times just asking if anybody had any information about Tom Clark, any letters, and I had, you know, there was one fella wrote to me and just said, listen, make sure you do not say he was born in the Isle of Wight. He was born in a small part of an isthmus just up from the Isle of Wight. It wasn't the Isle of Wight, you know, so, but, you know, to all intents and purposes, it's just off the Isle of Wight. His father was in the British Army. His father was a Protestant from Carrigaline in County Leitrim, who joined the British Army in 1847 and had fought in the Crimean War from 1853 to 1856, and then settled back home in Dungannon in County Tyrone. So Clark, from the age of 7 to roughly 22, as I've already said, he lived there. And it's interesting that when he's in, direct reference to your question, when he's in America, he goes on what they call these Clonmacnoise picnics, and he's going with the Tyrone branch all the time. You know, so he's heavily affiliated towards Tyrone. But I mean, there is a letter that he writes in 1893 to a colleague in Strabane in County Tyrone, where he just says, you know, I may wear their broad arrow uniform, but there's not a hint or a doubt that I'm in my Celtic heart that I'm an Irishman, proud now as ever I was. You know, and this is 10 years of imprisonment at this stage.
For, you know, a New York audience, then do you think, I mean, overall it sounds like New York was a bit of a disappointment for Clark, or rather I suppose it'd be fair to say he wanted to be in Ireland. Is that your sense of him?
Well, I mean, again, it's, you know, when you're looking at the letters, sometimes you have to read between the lines, but and the letters are circumscribed by the number of times that both Kathleen Clark, his wife, and himself are separated, so there are gaps in them. You know, there's very little from 1905 to 1908, for example, but you know, he writes to her at one stage in 1908, and at this stage it's all about, you know, buying the shop, stocking the shop, you know, fitting it out and how things are going and noting how rivals have closed and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, he does make reference to the fact that he says to her, you know, I don't think we regret coming back. You know, so there is this, you know, should we have come back maybe? Which again knocks on the head this idea that he was coming over to Ireland to start a rising, you mm-hmm. know, that he was living his life. So life in New York, I mean, there was a big social aspect to it, and he was going out to a lot of meetings. Being typical Clark, he was always sitting at the back, as he said. But in terms of, you know, I don't know if he looked for a reward for the time he had spent in prison. It's the wrong term, but, you know, as if for people to recognise the fact that this man had done his time, 15 and a half years.
But at the same time, he complained of people kind of wanting a piece of him. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes, exactly.
So it didn't sit easily with him then?
No, no. And I mean, he was a very proud man. He was quite prepared to stand up to various individuals. But he just, you know, New York comes across as somewhere that if things had worked out, he probably would have stayed here.
Right.
But they just didn't for him, you know. And maybe, you know, with the first child, they wanted to go back to Ireland because that is a possibility, you know. Kathleen Clark was ill. I mean, for example, in 1905, she went home for 6 months back to Limerick, you know. So, and that had a major burn. So if his wife wasn't happy, then, of course, she says in her memoirs that Tom convinced me eventually to go back to Ireland. But, you know, she's writing from a particular perspective, mm-hmm. you know, which we have to bear in mind. So, but all in all, it seems that when he got into Dublin, he was a successful businessman, you know, with the John Daly money behind him. And he actually writes to John Daly and says, you know, there's no other man in my life that has done as much for me. How can I ever repay you? And he ends up owning two shops in Dublin and, mm-hmm. and doing extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so which again tackles this question of, you know, you will get people say, oh, well, of the 1916 proclamation signatories, you know, one was already close to death, Joseph Plunkett. Tom Clark was an old man. Well, he wasn't. He looked a lot older than he actually was, but he was a very successful businessman. And these people would have met in the Clarence Hotel and had tea there. You know, so these weren't people from the back streets who had nothing to lose. He had a lot to lose. You know, if you look at the casualties of the rise and the victims of the rise, and a lot has been made of this the last few years by people in Dublin that, you know, well, forget about the Republicans who died. Let's look at the innocent victims. But if you look at the human perspective, Kathleen Clark lost, first of all, she lost her husband. He was executed on the 3rd of May. Her young brother, Ned Daly, was also executed. Her uncle, John Daly, died of motor neuron disease a month after the executions, and she suffered a miscarriage. So there was a woman's life destroyed, and she was left with three young boys to educate, to feed, to clothe, whatever, you know.
I was blown away by the fact, it was only when I read your biography of Clark, Jared, that I realised that it was the first biography since LaRue, was it, in 1936?
Yes.
Why was he not written about more between your book without Wexford?
2011.
11, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's very, very easy to demonise people if you don't know about them. You know, so you can look at what they did from 1914 onwards, and then you can just fit them into a nice pigeonhole and say they were this and they were that. But when you actually look into these people's lives, you find that there was a life beyond what happened politically. And you can't help but empathise with somebody like Clark, you know, spent 15 and a half years in prison, what he went through, the fact that he kept himself sane, a highly intelligent, educated man who may well have gone on to be a teacher, which in those days was a very high calling. You know, he'd have done extremely well. He was a monitor in his local school. He helped the teacher and all that. And it's, you know, when you look at the likes of him, when you look at the likes of Sean McDiarmid, who I wrote a biography of in 2004, you know, there's humour in their letters. They come across as being human beings.
Mm.
So then your perspective changes on them, and you have to actually start asking the question, well, why did they lay their lives on the line? You know, I mean, there was a biography brought out on Robert Emmett a few years ago, and in the footnotes, the author claimed that Porrick Pierce's love of Robert Emmett bordered on necrophilia. Now, people who are writing from that perspective can get away with it, because certain agencies in Ireland seem to be quite happy with that revisionist aspect of history, whereas I think as a historian, the sources guide you. You know, if you come across a body of letters, you don't go in and say, well, I'm not going to use this one or this one because they don't fit what I'm trying to mm-hmm. write here. You actually take everything, it makes your work more complicated, more complex, more difficult. But at the end of the day, you're trying to create a rounded picture. You may not agree with what the person did, but you're trying to show people maybe what influenced them and why they did it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what you're looking at.
I think, Jared, for me, one of the aspects of the whole period, and particularly now as we approach, and, you know, I'm sure like myself, you've mixed feelings about centenaries and what comes out and how it jolts us in terms of a scurry to publish stuff, sometimes not very good, etc., etc. And then it's another way, as a historian, I think you acknowledge, because as a historian you're interested in dates and kind of marking, you know, chunks of time, and 100 years is an interesting period to look back on. One of the things that has struck me about that period is how sometimes from the Irish perspective we forget about, or we don't pay enough attention to, the role of the Irish abroad and the Irish diaspora in terms of what happened during that period. You know, and specifically, I suppose, over the last few years, I've been privy to, or I've been more sensitive to, the role of New York, to the role of Irish America in terms of what happened and how it was supported and facilitated.
I agree completely. I mean, you know, to put it bluntly, without Irish America, there would have been no 1916 rising. It's as simple as that. I mean, when I was researching the McDermott book, what came through so, so strongly was that, for example, Joe McGarrity, who lived in Philadelphia, was from Carrickmore in County Tyrone, and he made and lost millions. A confidant of John Devoy, very close to Pat McCartan, who was also native of Carrickmore. And when McCartan's writing, Bulmer Hobson's writing to McGarrity in 1906-07, when they're forming what were known as the Dungannon Clubs, very much a Republican organisation in Belfast, composed of a variety of different religions and positions and people in different aspects of society. And they're talking about various personal grievances and grudges and people not pulling their weight, etc. And the line that keeps coming back from America, whether it be from John Devoy or Joe McGarrity, is, listen, remember what this is all about. Remember who the enemy is. You're working towards one goal. Forget about personalities, differences. We'll keep supplying you with the money if we know that you're working in the right direction, you know. And this comes through then when the Volunteers are formed in 1913, November 13th, in Dublin, the Irish Volunteers. That's when the Irish Americans really make the move for, right, okay, now these people need money. They need to be armed. In fact, John Daly in Limerick, he was the linchpin because he was a Fenian. He was one of the few surviving Fenians at this stage. And everything that mattered from America came through John Daly. And everybody who came to prominence in the organisation in later years, Pierce, Plunkett, McDonough, etc., they all made their way to John Daly's house in Limerick. But the close associates were Tom Clark and Sean McDermott. Mm. And McDermott, for example, McDermott visits Jersey City in 1912 for an important conference for the Clonmacnoise. Virtually nothing is known about that. And that would be typical. It was secrecy. Secrecy was the cement that kept the IRB and the Clonmacnoise together, you know. And they were paranoid because they knew what informers had done. And McDermott was the great admirer of Robert Emmet. And he often commented how, you know, informers had ripped Robert Emmett's proposed plan, the rising rather, to shreds. So America comes across as being extremely important.
It poses challenges for us as historians, doesn't it? You know, the secrecy and the, you know, obviously
yes.
the need for it. It makes our...
It's frustrating.
Yeah,
because you're hoping that there's going to be a comment about something that happened there and it comes across nothing. And actually what they did at the time, in the case of McDermott, he writes to his girlfriend and he'd say, Min Ryan. Min Ryan actually married Richard Mulcahy, who became the chief of staff of the Free State Forces in the 1920s. And he writes to Min Ryan, for example, saying, you know, I met you-know-who and we talked about you-know-what. And that's it in the letter, and you're banging your fist off a table because, you know, what was that about? You know, but that's the way they operated. She knew who and what he was talking about, but nobody else was going to know.
Well, I think that's a great way to end. Listen, Jared, thanks for sitting down with us today. It's great to hear about this research, and I hope the next time you're passing through New York, you might take the time to stop by again.
Pleasure. Many thanks.
We're coming towards the end of the programme for another week, folks. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, our email is ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to www.nyuirish.net/radiohour or to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WBNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus fanacht.